And then finally, I woke up to lies that we were being told. Ever since then, I've been a peace activist.
What was it like going to your first protest?
It was a march down Ridgecrest Avenue.
In Albuquerque?
In Albuquerque.
What did it feel like?
It felt strange because it was such a shift in thinking.
Was there a particular event during the Vietnam War that sort of turned you around?
No, it was just kind of a gradual evolution, just time after time after time, seeing that we were being misled about what was happening. And then when I went to Nicaragua during the Contra War.
In the 1980s?
Yes. I really was awakened to the falsehoods and the how we are blinded about what's really going on, because I saw what was going on down in Nicaragua, and it was not pretty. And they came back home and read the papers, and it was just the exact opposite of what was really going on. And then that was the final blow to my accepting what was put out by the government.
What took you down there?
I went on a work brigade picking coffee, and then I went back again on another brigade to help build a schoolhouse, and then I went to a Spanish language school.
What was the draw to go down there?
There was a woman who came to Albuquerque and sang at the Unitarian Church, and she had been there, and she talked to me and said I should go. And I thought about it, and I thought that was right, I should go. So I went.
You wanted to see for yourself?
Yes.
I know you and your husband founded the Albuquerque chapter of Veterans for Peace. Why do veterans have a specific insight that makes them good peacemakers?
The combat veterans are the real voice of the Veterans for Peace, because they know what's been going on and what terrible crimes are being committed, and their consciences can't stand that, so they work against it. And the rest of us who are not combat veterans have to agree with them. They know the terrible, terrible situation of war, and how all the wars are one-sided. Just because we have, quote, superior armaments doesn't make us good people. So we're opposed to violence and exploitation.
Did your peace work influence how you taught kids in school?
Yes, I tried to install the idea of justice in the students, and I think that I was successful to a reasonable extent.
You did a lot of traveling in the 80s. You went on a peace march to Washington?
I went on a peace march across the country from Los Angeles to New York and then down to Washington.
How long did that take?
8.5 months. It was to protest nuclear weapons and to try to get nuclear disarmament.
What did you do in Washington when you got there?
We had a big finale at the Mirror Pool by the Washington Monument.
Why do you feel it's important to keep doing these kinds of marches, even though it seems like we don't make progress sometimes?
We have to do what little we can. If we don't do anything, it's going to be worse than it is. Sometimes it feels hopeless, but always we have to maintain a little hope.
You also went to the Soviet Union and did a march?
Yes. When we were doing the march across the country, a lot of times truckers would yell at us, "Why don't you do this in Russia?" And so there was a young man on the march named Alan Affelt who said, "Yes, why don't we do this in Russia?" And he was very enterprising. He managed to get visas for people who wanted to go. and made arrangements to get citizens of the Soviet Union involved. We had 200 Americans and 200 citizens of the Soviet Union on a march from what was then called Leningrad, now it's called St. Petersburg, to Moscow. We had a 4th of July celebration in Moscow.
What was it like?
The young people of Russia were just so enthusiastic about having Americans that were with them instead of hating them. And as a matter of fact, people of all ages welcomed us with open arms at every village that we stopped. People would come out, bring us flowers, bring us little trinkets of things that they valued, and then they gave them to us. At every village, they brought out huge loaves of bread, flat bread, about 14 inches in diameter, with a hole in the middle and a little vase with salt in it, in the hole in the middle. And bread and salt was their symbol of welcome. I think that was probably really one of the highlights of my life, was meeting with those Russian people that were so tired of war and so happy that there were Americans that wanted peace.
How have you tried to do that since then?
One of the people that I met on that march was a man from Turkmenistan, one of the Soviet republics at that time, and he and I compared notes about our cities, and we decided to become sister cities. So we still are a sister city with Ashgabat, Turkmenistan, and it's an ongoing project.
Have you gone there?
I think I've been there about 29 times. Initially, that was the only way I could find out what was going on over there, because telephone service was just awful, and there wasn't any email at that time. And so one time I went over there and stayed for 4 weeks, so I would really experience the life of the people of Turkmenistan. There has been a big evolution in Turkmenistan. They call themselves a democracy, but unfortunately they're not. It's very definitely a dictatorship.
When we think about other countries like that, we're like, oh, it's a dictatorship. But the kind of program you're doing, where you're going and staying and visiting, you actually get to meet the people. So the country is not just the government; it's the people you meet. Why is that so important in peacemaking?
It's the only thing that's open to us. People-to-people kinds of things, because government-to-government is down the drain. Both their governments and our government are not interested in the people, but the people can still be interested in the people, and they're wonderful people over there. Yeah.
Were you involved with protests around the Iraq War?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The Peace Center...
Albuquerque Peace and Justice Center.
Yeah, the Albuquerque Peace and Justice Center was very much opposed to both invasions, Afghanistan and Iraq.
Before, at the beginning of the war, it could be very unpopular to oppose it. Did you run into that?
Yes. Yeah, you always do. At the beginning, at the middle, and the end, you run into opposition, because people are propagandized and brainwashed.
You've continued doing this, you know, into your 90s. You're 95 now?
Yes.
You went, I think, a few years ago on another walk from Albuquerque to Santa Fe of 13 days to protest money in politics. Why did you want to do that?
Until we get money out of politics, we're going to continue in the same bad path that we're in, because the votes for lawmaking are in favor of militarism and violence, mm-hmm. that are profitable. That's what our economy is about, is about war making and destruction and killing, rather than constructive things like schools and hospitals and
Wasn't it difficult to walk 13 days? Were you 91?
Yes.
And you can't, what did you do overnight?
I was offered home hospitality every night. I slept in a bed, and then I would go back to where I was, where I left off the day before, and continue.
You could have driven to Santa Fe and rallied in front of the roundhouse. Why was it important to walk?
Nobody would have known anything about it if I'd driven. Hardly anybody knew about it when I walked, because the papers didn't give it much emphasis, and one TV station mentioned it, and unfortunately they said that the purpose of the walk was to cut government spending, which really made me angry, because I don't think we should cut government spending except what we call defense, which should be cut radically.
You were also involved in the Raging Grannies. What is that?
Well, it's a group of women that put on silly hats and long skirts and sing songs that are against the war, against injustice. And we write new words to old songs so we can pass them around. We have what we call gaggles of grannies all over the country. They started in Canada. They were protesting nuclear weapons. They did it because they kept trying to talk to reporters and media about the problems and didn't get any response, so they decided if they acted a little outrageously that they would get more attention, and they did. It's spread all over the country now.
Why did you want to do that particular kind of protest?
Because I agreed that we had to find new innovative ways to bring the message to people that the present situation is not acceptable.
Well, it's funny because it challenges the stereotype of little old ladies who don't really do anything, so it kind of takes that and reverses it.
Yeah. Yeah. I write a lot of the songs.
Do you still perform them?
Yes, absolutely. We sing every Tuesday at Golden Fourth in Albuquerque.
Why do you choose that day, that time, that place?
Well, that's where the offices of the congressional delegation are. That's why we choose that place. The time is because it's a noon hour. People are out of their offices for lunch, so they see us and hear us.
Do you ever have people stop and listen or ask you questions?
Once in a while, not often enough. It's like in the song Blowing in the Wind, how many times can a man turn his head, pretending he just doesn't see?
You also went to a protest at President Bush's ranch in Texas.
Yes.
Right, during the war.
Cindy Sheehan lost her son. She was demanding of the president that he tell her what noble purpose it was that she had lost her son for. But again, he turned his head. He pretended he just didn't see.
It can be a lonely life, trying to be a peacemaker. Maybe not lonely, but frustrating if you're waiting to see results of what you do.
Sometimes it seems like it'll never happen, but we have to remember that women's right to vote, it was 100 years, and it finally happened. So we just have to keep at it and keep at it and hope that eventually we're going to have results.
What other issues are you focusing on?
I am in an action group called Ending Wars and Occupation, and we are honing in on the idea that the reason that people are willing to accept the terrible indignity of keeping these wars going is that they are told that it's necessary for the economy. We are working on the idea that we must change from a war economy to a peace economy, because we could circulate the money just as well with nonviolent, productive things as we're doing with violent, nonproductive, and destructive things. we've got to change this idea of American exceptionalism. There are two very, very serious consequences of the idea of American exceptionalism, and that is sanctions of other countries and regime change. We don't have any right, any universal right, to declare sanctions on other countries. But because we are exceptional, we do it. We don't have a right to go in and say, you can't be president, even if you were elected, because we want somebody to, that will do our bidding.
Throughout all your years, you've continued to do this. Why has it been important for you personally, even if it seems like there aren't changes? What does it mean for you to keep doing it?
Well, there have been changes. Some things have improved. So that gives me hope. I mean, the idea that we're accepting gay marriage, for example, if we keep on keeping on, it's going to pay off eventually. That's where I am. And I hope that that can be broadly accepted, especially by the young people, because they're the ones that it's important for them, because they're the ones that are going to be living with it. There have been some bad setbacks, but at the same time, there's a glimmer of hope.
You're a charter member in the Peace and Justice Center here. Why was that important for you and your husband to do that?
We need to unite as much as possible, and having a physical place to meet and an identity. There are many, many people that feel like you do and like I do, but if we don't have any way to connect, we feel isolated. To have a physical place seems to be very important to me.
Even though we have those phones and things and the internet?
Yeah. It's still a connection that's very valuable, I think.
You can't travel much anymore as you used to all over the world, but how do you hope to keep connections with people in other countries and here in our community?
Well, I am doing a little bit of traveling. I went to the Encuentro at Nogales. It was a conglomeration of a lot of different groups, and the one that I'm most connected with is the School of America's Watch.
What did you do down there?
We had workshops, and the most important thing was connection with people from all over the country.
What was the focus of the workshops?
There was one about deported veterans. There were a lot of others. It was about immigrants and about the School of America's Watch.
The focus was on immigration issues and the border and people coming across for asylum.
Yes.
Why did you want to stay involved in those particular issues?
Because the people of Central America are being terribly, terribly treated, unjustly treated, and we need to change that in any way we can.
You know, there's a lot of asylees coming through Albuquerque right
now. Oh, yeah. When I was living in my house, I was hosting them for a night or two. I took care of quite a number of them from Central America. Mm-hmm. I just got to the point where I didn't have enough room and I was tired, so I just came over here.
Some people might think, I mean, Dorothy Day always rejected, people would say, oh, you're a saint. And she said, no, you shouldn't say that, because then people think they can't do what I'm doing. Do you ever feel that way, that what you're doing is not unusual? Everybody can do this.
I just feel like there are people that have done so much more than I have that what I've done is pretty much insignificant. I've done what I could, which I'm happy about, but I admire people that have been picked out a subject and stuck with it and done it year after year after year.